it just strikes me when I start talking about this stuff, there's always this sense, whether subtle or overt, of what's in it for me. And the me is always some kind of component of that world field and how it can be used in that field of relations to be bigger, better, happier, faster, stronger, whatever, more functional. We'll call that self, that part that functions in the world field. What's in it for me is how can I burnish that object that relates to a world field made up of parts and structures and relations? And it's always in comparison to, in a sense, over and against all the other entities in that world field. Some might be perceived as threats, some as opportunities, some as experiences, but all of it is interpreted and filtered by a certain mental structure that I'll call ego, purely in relation to the self and making it bigger and better. Its dream is to stand out against the other relative objects, the other particular individuals in the world field. There's a white-knuckled death grip on the self and its sense of power and prestige and influence, because that's the only game in town for that logic I'm calling ego. And that's it. And the thing is, it's nothing and it perishes. It's an illusion married to a futility. It's basically nothing, and yet it's kind of like a nightmare for anyone caught up in it with no recourse of escape or no perceived recourse of escape. So when I, as a conscious being, speak of freedom, of conscious realization of reality, like I'm doing now, it's kind of automatic. It's like an automatic click in the brain that's like, what's in it for me? And when it really comes down to it, the answer is there is nothing in it for you. The problem is the self. It is the me. And that's really the root of it. Ego is the problem. It's a misperception, and that kind of drives the machine, seeking pleasure, avoiding pain. And at some point, there's a realization, perhaps dimly or perhaps acutely, that if you pursue pleasure as a way out of suffering, for example, say pain is suffering, boredom is suffering, that's painful. But I'm just talking about, when I say the word pain, yeah, it includes all that, but you could think of like just having a headache or something, or just a generalized sense of, is this all there is? That's really what it is. Anxiety, maybe a certain kind of depression in the background, and sadness, and how do I get out of this? Well, let's seek pleasure. That's one way, try to solve it. But pleasures pass, and then it turns into its opposite at some point. Just look at an addict. Sad example, but heroin's great. I've never done it, just to be clear, but I've heard it's just when you really get a good heroin hit, you feel like everything's great. It's like, oh, I could just be here, you know? Thing is, it passes. It always does, because that's what the world field does. It passes. The elements within it pass. It's built in. Just like a wave followed by a trough. So you're goosing your dopamine and your nucleus accumbens and you feel great. But then when it's exhausted, you have less of it than you did before you started. So you feel like crap. You're stealing from your own personal piggy bank and you pay later. So why do people want to wake up? Well, they want to get out of suffering. So they want to get away from pain. It looks to me like the most conventional way that people try to escape pain is to seek pleasure. The problem with that is, to the degree that you seize upon pleasure as the answer, you're empowering its polar opposite, namely pain, and you realize they're part of the same continuum of suffering and you're fucked. So that doesn't work. So, you know, some people may realize that and then get really bummed out because that seems like that's kind of all there is. then you might get this sense of vacuity or emptiness or ennui. And that's when you start to realize, okay, there's more going on here. There's something about the world that doesn't add up that I'm not happy about. The pleasure and pain cycle is built into the organism, into the world structure and how that works. And you have to zoom out and look at it, or zoom in or zoom out, but you try to understand how that works. First of all, it's not the answer to seek pleasure by itself. Obviously, you can enjoy things and experience pleasure. It's just there's this wisdom that says that pain will follow, so you don't cling to either. You might enjoy a meal, but you're well aware that once the satiety of your meal wears off, you're going to feel empty again. If you're just allowing that, there's a happiness that includes or allows for all of that coming and going, but it's not attached to it. It doesn't seek it as an end in itself or as a way out of suffering. So if one starts to realize, not everyone does, in this slice of history, certainly not everyone is having that realization that pleasure and pain are not the answer. But those of us who start to realize that, like, this ain't working. You might get a little depressed. You're like, wow, maybe that depression was there the whole time. There's something wrong here. What's going on with this? You start to study it. What it boils down to is you start to study the self and its attachments and addictions and compulsions and regrets and desires and aversions and blah, 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 and all that. You start to realize that the self is problematic. So it could come through like, oh, something's wrong with me. What's wrong with me? Then maybe you hear about a spiritual teacher who says, I have the answer. You go to a talk or a workshop, learn to meditate. I mean, like a true teacher, not some charlatan trying to rope you in more deeply to samsara, which there's a lot of that, just so you know. At some point, you become more uncomfortable in a way. So if there's a world field, there's also a field of awareness that manifests as certain qualities, stillness. One could sit with that for a while, stillness, peacefulness, and a certain understanding, but not mentally, an inner standing, an interoception, an appreciation or recognition of the value of something that's entirely transcendent of the world field and of the world entirely. And that sounds, objects, thoughts, sensations arise within the stillness and they don't have any power over it any more than a tiny little bit of plankton has power over the entirety of an infinite ocean. It's hard to describe that. There is an isness. See, it starts to sound really ridiculous if you try to use language, because the language is always subject, object, and world relations. So it can get kind of weird sounding, but the realization of it's not weird at all. It's the language about it that can be difficult. Say we go to a meditation retreat and sit for a long time. There's peacefulness, there's stillness, and there's a substance, but it's not anything I can see, feel, hear, think, or taste, touch in a physical sensory way, and yet I feel really relaxed. But one may not become relaxed. One may become more anxious at a glimpse of this because the ego really starts to worry about things and get distracted sometimes, so that's not so relaxing. But if there's an intuition of that isness, that reality, with a capital R, that which actually is consciousness prior to, already, always prior to thought, feeling, sensation, and all worldly objects, we may come into a struggle. It could be kind of more subtle. It is kind of a struggle. It's just usually struggle is overt, like we're fighting with something. This is more like a subtle play of desire and will, self-will. Desire is based on this idea, oh, I don't have X, I want X. I want to get X and have it. It's based on not having it. Because if you already have it, you don't desire it because it's already yours. So there's a subtle quality of, there's an intuition of this isness. I can tell it's more real than anything I've ever thought, felt, tasted, dreamed, imagined. All of that fades in importance to whatever this is. Stillness is an excellent quality to bring one to a point where it may be realized directly. Even it's all there, so even a fraction of it is very bountiful and has no limit. So because we're conditioned to obtain, have, and want things in the world field, we think, okay, how can I have this thing? And it sets up a dynamic where we feel inadequate. And that's part of it. Our efforts to obtain what Jesus called the pearl of great price, conscious awareness of reality, the reality of it, the truth of it, the satisfying qualities that we intuit, that we start to notice this mechanism of desire. Because we're so conditioned to try to, like, where can I get it? Where can I buy it? Where can I have it? It implies we don't have it. And because it's an already-ness, it sets up a conflict within us where that desire mechanism starts to get frustrated. And the only way through that really is to continue to practice and study and become more still. And in that stillness, be able to study how that works, the mechanism of desire, and how its logic is based on, like I said, it's an illusion married to a futility. The whole quote-unquote American dream or European dream, Indonesian dream, and Japanese and everyone else. So why do we want to be free? Chasing pleasure doesn't work. And avoiding pain doesn't work either. We learn to be more at peace with that. But that's not enough. We realize there's this ground state of boredom, ennui, that, and the root of the word ennui comes from the French, which is also the root of the word to annoy. So we're annoyed by our own existence, by the existence of things. The existentialist philosophers live on that plane where things are annoying and boring. And how do we break out of that? And that's a bigger topic. But if we get into meditation, real meditation, we're past the point where we're really seeking that. But then we realize, in a much more subtle way, usually, we start to notice that we're bringing that mechanism to our practice. And that's okay. Because the point is to, like, if we're a scientist, we take our specimen and put it in a petri dish, or if it's very small, put it under a microscope and it's under a slide or something with a bright light and look at it, isolate it, look at it very carefully. If it's a microbe, try to see what it's doing and get really still, very calm, relaxed, and focused. Not lazy and spaced out. Utterly calm and still, and yet alert. And we look at what the mind is doing and its desire. And you realize it's unhappy and it's just frustrating itself, and it's based on that frustration. Its very existence is in being frustrated. And that's why that ennui comes up. It's annoying. It's how it is. That's really suffering. That's dukkha, you know. Unsatisfactoriness is caused by desire, very simply, because desire implies that we don't have it already, or we are not it already. That's a lie, because suchness or reality, truth itself, already is, always already is, even now, already. So desire is based on the lie we don't have it already, or that we aren't it already. So you have to get really, really still and quiet and just see how that works. And as you see it, the more you see it and see how it works, the less effective it is at telling you who you are, and the more authentic you become, and the more you embody your true nature. Because remember, consciousness is not only your essence, it's an activity. So your conscious activity then is to see what the mind is doing with great awareness and just studying it merely to find out how it works. It's subtle, you see. Because like, well, my life would be better if I could see how this works. Really? You mean it's in the future and you don't have it yet? And see, as I say that, I'm watching that statement. Wow, isn't that interesting? It generates dissatisfaction for itself and then is frustrated at the result. And it doesn't stop until we realize that that's not who we are. We just see it. And it dies.